You saw that video I sent you.
Yeah.
What was it of?
What was that?
What was it of?
Oh, it was just one of those silly internet videos that, you know, guys never learn how to cook. And it's, you know, here's a recipe about how to cook. And, you know, it's just, you know, two friends helping you, or a friend just helping another guy out, you know, just increasing the old, you know, the knowledge about recipes, you know, just that. That's about it. That's what the video was about. I appreciate it.
How to cook fancy meals. It's a little fancier meal, wasn't it?
It was a little bit fancier. Yeah. It involved, you know, some peppers. Yeah, some sauce, that kind of stuff. Yeah.
What happened at the end?
Oh, you really want to get into the end?
They poach an egg or two in there?
You know, yeah, they did. They did put an egg in there. It's interesting you sent that to me.
I know. As well, a buddy of mine, Stefan, sent me that video. And then a week before he sent me the video, he texted. He's like, hey, man, I just started listening. Like, sorry it took so long, but, you know, I'm liking it. Talking about it.
Appreciate it.
So, yeah. So it was cool. And then he sent me the video, and he's like a foodie guy. His Instagram page is like mostly pictures of fancy meals he's cooked. So I watched it and didn't catch like why he sent it. It's like, oh, that's a neat meal. And then it's like, oh, wait. At the end, he must have just listened to episode 3. Because he's going back. He's starting from the beginning. Like, years ago when we first started this, we had a little
argument. It's a deep cut. It's definitely a deep cut.
But I appreciated it. He was sending me and he's a fancy food guy. And so he sent me
those that are in the dark right now, early on in the podcast, Matt told me that he made essentially spaghetti sauce and then put eggs in it, poached eggs in it. And I thought that was kind of a unappealing meal. Made fun of him on the podcast. He's since gotten he's gotten support from our listeners.
Turns out it's a halfway normal thing.
It's a halfway normal thing, and I apologize for my culinary limited knowledge. I don't know.
Yeah, Peter thought it was bizarre.
It was
a weird situation for me because I thought that was normal. Although I do bizarre things with food.
Yeah.
Like I put raw egg in coffee and just drink it down.
Yeah,
and that's not normal. You won't hear me arguing that that's normal, but that's something I do, and it's weird. And I was just kind of weirdly offended because the poached egg and the spaghetti sauce is actually, I think, a normal culinary thing.
The raw egg and the coffee sounds like an influencer thing, like a tactic.
I was doing it before.
I know.
It's a big thing on like what do you call it? Workout guy. Twitter,
yeah,
like they do raw eggs now, but I was doing it back before I even had Twitter, before it was a thing. Just so everybody.
Do you ever get the algorithm where it's some guy? I think it's on YouTube. I see these. He's got a long beard and he's always talking about how much, pardon my French, poop you have in you and how you have to get rid of it by doing this diet. And you just have, and he says some number and it doesn't sound like a logical number. He's like, you have 18 pounds of, and it's like, come on, man. I'm just I don't want to watch this. He's trying to sell me, you know, some sort of, I don't know exactly, some sort of smoothie recipe, some sort of diet. And he's like, you know why you're heavy? You just got all, and it's like, I don't like that.
No, that's interesting. I don't get that. The algorithm must be more tailored to you.
I don't know what that. Yeah, maybe.
I get weird esoteric type things.
Maybe it's because I have stomach issues. I have had stomach issues.
Yeah, I do think. You Google a lot of like why my tummy hurt.
Yeah.
You get.
I've been known to dabble.
That's probably why.
Why my tummy hurt?
Yeah.
Do you ever Google stuff like your search thing and it's just you're like, I could put this so much more clearer, but right now I'm just going, why my tummy hurt bad, right side? And you're like, Google, just take over and finish.
Yeah, they know
what I'm looking for, right?
Yeah. Did you mean why does my stomach hurt? Like it kind of hurts you. It's like I did.
Belly pain center. want to cry.
My phone still has, I have the Android version where if you're typing, the spell suggests. So I'm typing something, it'll give you three possibilities. And sometimes I'll forget how to really spell a word, but I'll like, oh, the suggest will fix it for me. But I realize I'm so far off.
Oh, yeah.
The word, it doesn't even give me the option. It's like, where's coincidence? I don't know. Like, how do I?
That's a day ruiner when you get a couple of those. You're like, I can't even get close enough that the AI can't say, hey, are you trying to spell, you know, coincidence? Good one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe something like that. Or like, it moves on so fast and you click the suggested ones. You don't have to type out a whole word, but it's moved on and you send a text or something and you realize, instead of saying thank you, it's like T capital Y. I'm like, hey, sorry. Yeah, sorry. I meant thank you. Not T Y L. Like, or just whatever it moved on to.
Yeah. Spelling's gotten worse. People's handwriting, I feel, has gotten worse.
People's handwriting's probably always bad.
No, you read those, you see those old letters. It's all cursive. It's all.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Cursive. Do people learn cursive anyway, you know, nowadays?
Actually, I don't know. I never write in cursive.
But everyone in our generation, I assume you had to learn how to write cursive at some point.
But I never continued. Like, we never had to keep writing it throughout junior
high. That's true. That's a good point. So, that's a good point.
And I like to write, my notes are all longhand, but they're not cursive.
Your notes? I think, do you ever do all capitals? You ever try that out? I've dabbled in that in the old. I tried that once in school. Kind of looks cool.
Also, I couldn't do the whole, it slows me down to do all capitals, but like on my notes here, mm-hmm. I have, if I want to like something to stand out, especially, this is like a little podcast trick.
Okay.
I want the main point to stand out because I don't have time to read a whole paragraph. I have like
a few words.
My little preview of my notes for tonight. I was wondering if he was reverse Milton. And reverse Milton is in all caps, right? So it's like, you don't know what that means, but I'm going to have to explain it.
Yeah.
But anyway, but like reverse Milton is in all caps. And so, and then court historian or, and then all caps, accidental profit.
I'm lost. We're reading the same book and I don't know where you are.
I'm just saying. Those are my notes, and I have keywords in all caps. And so I look down, I don't have to read the I can just be, oh, accidental profit. Oh, Court Milton. Oh, Michael Jordan of tech books. Boom. There it is.
And on that note, welcome to There Will Be Books, a podcast about books and Matt's note-taking abilities. I'm Peter, joined as always by Matt.
That was okay. Do you think we lost any
listeners? No, we gained.
We did. I think our little Spotify subscriber thing went down a tick or two after after we picked Nicholas Sparks. I don't know.
Stop.
It's back up now.
Stop.
Oh no. Hey,
you get on the Sparks train. Quick note: we said that book title wrong the entire episode. A couple episodes ago, Rodanthe.
I'm not gonna say it.
Well, I would appreciate if you tried.
I'll pronounce it however Richard Gere pronounces it in the movie.
That's good. That's fair. Fair.
Fair.
Fair. I'll allow that. I'm pretty sure he pronounces it Rodanthe. I might be, if I mispronounce it two episodes, I think we just continue to mispronounce it.
We need to do prop bets for the movie.
That book?
Before we watch it in that book.
Yes.
We'll do it later, not now, but can be how I pronounce it. Will be. What made me think of that was thinking of, okay, do you think they're going to say the actual name of the movie as a line of dialogue?
Oh yeah.
Like, I bet it would be as a note. If it's like a voice, is there going to be a voiceover note from like Richard Gere or the girl? And then I remember our nights in Rodanthe. Right. I, what do you think? Plus 100, like, or negative. You think it's probably probable.
I look back on those nights in Rodanthe and think, what a memorable time. I made that minus, like the Jurassic Park. Mess that up.
Minus 150.
Yeah, probably. I listened back to my airport announcement on, was that last episode, two episodes ago? That was pretty good. I'm surprised we haven't gotten some reader mail about that.
So I had some Jurassic Park stuff in my other notes because we weren't sure if we were going to do what we're doing this week, which is kind of catching up on some stuff, and Homo Deus.
Yes.
We're going through that book bit by bit, which is kind of fun. But we weren't sure if we were going to do the cruise ship essay by David Foster Wallace. So Monday and Tuesday, I read pretty much the entire cruise ship essay, a supposedly fun thing I'll never do again, and really enjoyed it. But I had some, he watched Jurassic Park was one of the videos that showed on his cruise, and I had some Jurassic Park. We'll get to it next.
You know what one of the bigger disappointments in my reading life was? Not absolutely loving the book Jurassic Park by Michael Crichton. Way more dinosaur chase scenes than the movie.
I could see.
Yeah.
So basically, Wallace calls Jurassic Park plotless.
The movie?
Like, he loves the movie, and he brought it up because this is a cruise in the 90s. And so there were five movies that you were available to play. And he said he watched Jurassic Park like five times. And he said the basic plotlessness of it doesn't sink in until about the third viewing in the same day, you know? And I was like, oh, I don't know if I agree with that, but
I don't agree with that at all. How is it plotless?
I didn't watch it three times in a row, stuck on a cruise ship, you know what I mean? But anyway, it was kind of a...
The book kind of meanders. Not meanders, it's like action, but it's like repetitive.
That might be one of the few times where the movie's better than the book.
Have you read the book?
No.
Maybe at some point we read the book, but if I remember Crichton correctly, it wasn't my favorite.
Crichton kind of has a reputation as being maybe less artfully constructed, more machine-like writing.
More like the idea might sound as good, but the execution is a little...
Well, less literary, more...
Whatever. Can I do a little bit of a segue, Matt, from what I said here?
Yeah, no, let's move on.
I did I read books on the side. You know, library is my friend. I do a little over on our Patreon. I do a monthly little roundup of the books I read, checked out, had return, all that kind of fun stuff. All right. So, kind of stealing from that monthly article. It's not really an article. I read this book. I finished it a couple days ago. The book was called Goodnight Irene by Luis Alberto Urrea. Might be pronouncing that completely wrong. Author I've heard about. This book got some good reviews. I think it's probably going to be like, you know, maybe a bestseller. Right up my alley, Matt. Historical fiction taking place in World War II. If you know me, I like that. You know, I should be a home run.
You love that era.
Love that era. The book is about, and the author kind of takes inspiration from a true story about his mom. So I was like, okay, this everything's checking out right now. It's about Red Cross in World War II sent over women in sort of these van type things, kind of like almost like a food truck thing, where they would kind of behind front lines serve donuts and coffee and kind of cheer up the soldiers, right? And it's a story of like these two friends who do that. Maybe some of the 70 pages in, I'm loving it. I'm thinking this is a 5-star book. Do you ever gauge how you're liking a book and get like, oh, at the end, I know this is going to be one of my favorite books at the end of the year, right? Okay. Mm-hmm. I finished the book and I give it 2 stars out of 5, mm-hmm. which, if you know me, that's pretty bad.
Yeah. It
kind of slowly came to me that I was not liking the book. The dialogue was kind of childish. It was kind of PG-13 war movie type thing. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Serious subject matter, but like jokey tones all the time. The plot was not believable. It had this super patriotic tone sometimes to it that was like didn't match the characters I felt. It was just It was a bummer, Matt. It was a reading bummer that I didn't. I thought it was. 70 pages in, I was loving it. It's getting all. You go on Goodreads. The book has 4.2 rating. But I'm usually one to try to keep up with the trends. Maybe I should have lied and said, "Oh, it's a 4-star book." Can't lie to the listener.
Yeah.
Curious if other people have read this book. It's called Goodnight Irene. Just came out a couple months ago. Because a lot of people are loving the book. I don't know. Oh, the end was like extremely just made to be like, oh, how emotional. It's just not deserved.
Saccharin.
Yeah. Just, I don't know.
All right.
I felt like, what's wrong with me? What's wrong with me? As I kept asking myself. And at the end, I said, what's wrong with the book?
Exactly. Right? You internalize that sort of thing. You shouldn't. You know?
It bummed me out, though. I should have been reading, The Once and Future King, and here I am reading a 2-star book. Letting down my friend, my podcast buddy.
You got to find out. I don't mind you reading extra stuff. You got to find out about these things. I have heard about the book, though. That's an interesting. It's good to know.
I
read it. That'll put me over the edge. I probably won't do it.
I want you to read it. Because I have no one to talk about this book. I feel like I'm taking crazy pills. I couldn't find. Yeah. I don't know. Anyway.
You got the podcasters now.
Yeah.
No. It's good to know. We probably will never get Watson's face on.
Yeah, I just kind of bashed his book. But, yeah, that's a bummer. Anyway.
Hey, speaking of, did you know that in the medieval cosmology of the universe or of our solar system, there were seven planets? Jupiter, Mars, Sol, which is the sun, S-O-L, Luna, which is the moon.
Interesting.
Mercury, Venus, and Saturn.
Hmm.
Seven planets, and they each have their own characteristics and modes and ways of being. And the theory is they influence C.S. Lewis's The Chronicles of Narnia, and each of his seven books take on one of the characteristics of the planet.
I feel like you're reading a book about this. You told me about this, right?
I told you about this, and I told you I was going to talk about medieval cosmology a little bit once per episode.
Can I stop you real quick?
Well, until you finish Sword in the Stone, I was going to do.
Yeah. Oh, that's fair. If you and I, let's say we're just hanging out. We don't know, like, hypothetical, okay? We don't know that planets exist. And you and I are just friends, right, normally.
We don't know planets exist at all.
They have not been taught to us, all right?
Okay.
I said this is a hypothetical, all right?
Yeah, I'm trying to hang with you.
The planets exist, but we've never been told that the planets exist. Okay?
You
with me? Do you think either of us would ever discover planets on our own?
No. I don't know what I'm looking at.
Yeah. Okay, that's all I had to add to that story.
That's the symbol.
Can you say goodnight? Goodnight, Peter.
This will be on the podcast.
We're not editing that.
Matt's co-pilot is
okay. Nice, buddy.
That was a nice interlude to the the hard labor of podcasting.
Sometimes I'll look up in the sky and I'll hear like, oh, Venus is visible from I'll look up in the sky and it's like, that could be Venus, that could be a slow moving airplane. I honestly don't know. I don't know the stars.
I love the stars, but I don't know if I had it, if they don't make those star books.
My brother had a telescope and a big old astronomy book when I was growing up, and I would look through it sometimes, and I really, with the book, I couldn't. They're just dots.
Maybe I should be friends with your brother, because I had a telescope, too.
Yeah. Man. We should be friends with him. Not Thad. Thad wasn't a telescope guy.
He was not a telescope guy.
Thad is a jock. I was going to say something.
Cosmology, C.S. Lewis. That's where we're at.
Oh, yeah, that. Well, I actually started reading it kind of ironic. I started it just looking for something to goad you with.
Yeah.
I got the whole introduction. I was like, this book is good.
For the listener, hey, for the listener, I gave a bad review. What's the title of this book so people can look it up?
Planet Narnia by Michael Ward.
That's a pretty good title, actually.
So it was published in 2008.
Yeah,
I'll let you look at it. You should look at the blurbs. A lot of people, it wasn't like a known thing throughout Sanders' life, or until people are talking like back in 2008, like, oh, this guy cracked the code. Like, it sounds crazy. A lot of people were like, I came into it skeptical. Like, what is this? And then he convinced them. He won them over. And I read the introduction. It's like, oh, this is actually pretty interesting stuff.
I like
it. One extra tidbit, just an interesting tidbit, and we can move off a bit. You know the word consider?
Yeah, I'm familiar.
Come from the Latin con, which means with, and sidious, which means stars. So to consider something originally is kind of like to go with the stars.
I'll be honest, that wasn't as interesting as I was hoping it to be.
Oh, that's neat. I underlined it. It's like, oh, that is good stuff. Consider, go with the stars, to kind of look at the fate and go consider the big picture, right?
Mm-hmm.
Consider.
Do you know who you're talking to right now?
Just read The Sword and the Stone.
Okay. Where do you want to go next? Prop bets or Harari?
Harari, and we'll end with prop bets.
Okay. I like it. So if you're listening for the first time, this is a little bit, we're doing this a little bit an unusual dissection of a book. We're talking about Homo Deus over multiple episodes, over multiple weeks and months, kind of grappling with some of the stuff he kind of talks about, delves into our critiques, what we like, what we kind of think is interesting. And tonight is one of those episodes where we're kind of going into the book. So Matt, lead us off. What did you find interesting so far? Or concepts or things you disagree with? I've made a little bit more progress than you.
Yeah.
And I think I was a little bit more pessimistic the first episode we talked about him. I have to say, just a general thing, it's a little bit, it's improved. I'm almost halfway, or I'm about halfway through the book, and it improved. I'll just say that. I still have issues with some of his like train of thought. I get lost with how stuff connects with one another in the scheme of like how a book's constructed, like subject matter. I'm a little lost on this. So I'm curious, where's your head at with this book?
Well, first of all, while I'm thinking of it, that whole, he is kind of a hyper-caffeinated, I mean that in a good way, I'm hyper-caffeinated too.
Yeah.
But his it's kind of almost like train of thought. He's an interesting, entertaining writer. Our first episode, I was pretty skeptical too. I don't agree.
Would you consider him a gifted thinker, Matt?
Yeah.
Okay.
I would. So our first time through, I was pretty more harsh on him, and I wouldn't quite, you know, because I disagree with like the tech optimism and the whole humanity is going to become gods. And like, this is a terrible idea. It's this, the hubris is talked about in Frankenstein and plenty of, you know, sci-fi movies and whatnot. But moving on, I kind of start to realize, and he kind of explicitly says towards the middle here, he's not necessarily advocating for this. He's just kind of pointing out that what could happen. And doesn't he explicitly say kind of making predictions in a weird way can kind of help not bring things about? Or what is it? What is it? What's the point of making predictions if they can't change anything?
Yeah.
So he kind of shows his hand as to kind of what he's doing here. I don't know how on board with the tech optimism stuff he actually is, but he's not as naive as I thought in the initial episode we did on him. I think he kind of realizes there's some hazards to be navigated.
And he kind of steps back a little bit from just sort of tech will solve our issues. And
yeah.
We thought part of humanity is going to be like,
yeah,
how to cure everything.
And we're just like, and wait.
I had a point too when I was reading this. I think any book that's sort of like built around the idea of like predicting the future quickly like dates itself. Like 2016 is like, oh, this is I think that's when the book was either published or the final printing or whatever. It's like so much has happened and in 7 years or whatever that it's just a tough. I think it probably feels exciting in the moment. Like if any book was like, oh, 2023, this is like the, and then 2030 comes around, like that's stuff is changed.
And well, if you predict in 2016, you know, industrialized first world nations don't invade other nations anymore.
Yeah. Wow. That's an issue. I think, it's that first impression I think we got, I don't think it holds up throughout the book, but it is something that you kind of have to, it lingers with you a little bit as far as thinking, right?
Yeah, he's kind of processing stuff and he's not as, I think he realizes there's downsides and hazards to be navigated. I'm probably more cynical about this stuff than he is, but he's not. But I'm realizing he's not just a naive. He realizes the dangers too. But I was kind of, I was going through some of the earlier stuff and we'll get into where he kind of starts hedging here. But I thought this part was kind of funny. He's talking about immortality and people like Peter Thiel, the billionaire tech guy, who is one of the big guys trying to fund, you know, the immortality quest or whatever. Yeah, Peter Thiel is trying to become immortal. Many people are likely to dismiss such statements as teenage fantasies. Yet Thiel is somebody to be taken seriously. He is one of the most successful and influential entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley with a private fortune of $2.2 billion, which I thought that was kind of funny. You know, lest you think this is silly and naive, he is very rich. Well, that actually doesn't, that's not an argument.
And this is going to be morbid, okay? I get that. But it's been in the news, like a lot of people are talking about, and it's been a little bit like an uncomfortable discussion, I feel like. I'm talking about the submarine that the five kind of the founder and sort of like it's this rich people go in this little tiny submarine and it like tragically imploded near the Titanic. And it was like, there's a lot of like think pieces about it. And it's kind of like, okay, anyway, but it's a lot of like a really smart guy or not smart, rich guy puts a lot of money and sort of into something. And it seems like too good to be true. Like, oh, I'm using different, you know, material than other people. And there's more people that can go down with me and everything. And then sort of nature and science makes it like, oh geez, like very
reality. They pride in
reality. Yeah.
Well, they were like, I saw the video where they like pride of themselves and it's controlled with a Nintendo remote.
Yeah, it seems
like, yeah, neato. But
I know
it's wrong. Yeah.
But it feels like that sort of, you could see how people could be like easily drawn to that though, right? Like, look at this guys. They're obviously so smart because they're so rich, and that's a kind of almost, it's not, you know, ends up being true, but like people follow very rich people thinking that they're very smart, right?
And people follow enthusiastic people.
Enthusiastically, it could be. Reminding me of people being like, you know, cutting edge of everything is rich guys putting money into living longer, and sometimes it's, turns out to be tragically wrong, you know.
Or you just luck out financially, or even if you're actually a genius financially, like Thiel, a PayPal guy. That doesn't mean you're gonna get the keys to immortality. You know, it doesn't make it less child. My point there, I just highlighted, is kind of funny. Like, doesn't make him less childish for wanting to be immortal because he's a PayPal billionaire. You know, exactly like you're saying with the submarine. Those things don't necessarily transfer over.
Yeah. I don't know.
Well, and then you start getting into, there's stuff like this. I was kind of fascinating when he was talking about how, let's say the immortality stuff works and it's a kind of a class stratified thing too, right? Because only rich people will be able to afford the procedures and medicine that will essentially renew your cells every 10 years and make you immortal, but you won't be invincible, right? You could still get hit by a bus. You could still do whatever. It's just the normal degeneration and diseases won't kill you. And he's talking about how that will That would make for an actually a really anxious and anxiety, because you'd be so you're immortal. Immortality is within your reach, but nothing bad can happen. So would you just cloister yourselves away up in your penthouse or whatever? And he said, just there's a line of like, it would make for a really anxious group of immortals. And I had a little note. It's like, well, what kind of like, so the ruling class would be incredibly reclusive. And it's like, is this a good thing? But it was like, it turns
Wouldn't it be
out.
funny if like the people that were immortal and they're kind of secluded away, and then everyone else just kind of lived their life normally? It was like there were
I
two
mean,
separate, like almost realities. That's kind of
maybe.
interesting. I don't
Well, they
know.
kind of already live stratified. I mean, the world of the wealthy is a different world than the
Yeah,
one you and
that's true.
I
No, that's very
live
true.
in. But it's an interesting thought process to think about. Like, okay, so they're technically immortal, but they can be killed. So would they? What kind of like society would that create when your ruling class is paranoid and anxiety ridden? Kind of creepy, actually. Good sci-fi story or two in there. But then he starts talking about how if people kind of like, you get the little brain chips or whatever Elon Musk always talks about that'll make you superhuman, how that'll kind of phase out art and literature and stuff. And he's talking about that. And I was like, this is kind of sounding pretty bleak.
His theories about like computers and AI, because farther along in the book, and I'll let you continue, but he made a point that he often makes points that I 50 to 75% like sort of understand or like agree with. But then there's like part of it where he just kind of goes through it fast or makes like a general assumption that like a leap where I'm like, I don't know if that's entirely true. Like, I don't know. Like very big concepts. You kind of, oh, this is how it is, or, but I don't know. Anyway, continue.
Well, and he does that, and then he's kind of going through this stuff, and it's looking, it's like, this is, you may, even if you're right, this is really bleak. But then he kind of starts to show his hand, and he starts saying, like, I don't necessarily agree with this. He's pointing out the hazards
Yeah.
while on the way. He's saying, these are the predictions. These are what people are trying for. And here's the problems you're going to see on the way. So he's not as blindly optimistic as we originally thought. And then he seemingly drops a little reference
He
to,
backs away from like what we both kind of assume was like the PR function of the very wealthy, which it seemed at the very beginning of the book that it was that's where he was leaning toward. Maybe at the very end, that's where he kind of comes around to, because
I'm curious how he ends.
the book is structured in not a very easy way to describe, I would say. I just got to a part in the book where he almost he in an essay where you kind of outline what your essay is going to be about, kind of like that end sentence in the first paragraph. He almost had that in the midpoint of this chat, like in the middle of the book. And I was like, that's weird. He just felt like this throwaway like sentence. And I was like, is he doing the last sentence of like an introductory paragraph 200 pages into the book? That's odd. Like, and the, what I'll do next, and then I'll end with how it, and I was like, okay, that's odd way of organizing a book. So
Right there in the middle.
if it seems like we're kind of jumping around, it sort of reflects the book in a
He
way.
kind of jumps around too. I'm
Yeah.
on board with it because that's my ADD brain works that way too. But so he's doing all this kind of bleak looking stuff. And I'm like, man, is he? So my reverse Milton thing,
Yeah, how many, I was
that
curious.
was before. So with Paradise Lost and John Milton, there's this whole, he kind of, by laying out the motives, because in Paradise Lost, it's a big chunk of it is from Lucifer's perspective, right? And he kind of really got into what would motivate the Lucifer character to want to rebel against God. And by giving him motives and actual, like, legitimate reasons for doing so, by weaving those into a story, he kind of accidentally made the devil a sympathetic figure. And he did it on accident, but the culture is kind of absorbed. Milton's Lucifer is kind of sympathetic, right? That's this whole thing. So it's kind of like, Milton's Lucifer becomes sympathetic because you kind of identify with him. Yeah. So it's an accidental thing. So I was like, is he doing the reverse Milton?
Okay.
Right? By kind of just bluntly stating what's going to happen, but it's like bleak and scary. And so is he accidentally, you know, poisoning his own optimism by explicating this stuff just so matter-of-factly? Is he actually creeping the majority of people out?
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Does that mean? So then there's like, is it happening? But then towards the middle, he drops this part. He seemingly randomly starts talking about how Marx, Karl Marx, famous German philosopher. he wrote about how revolution was inevitable. And when he talked about the coming revolution, he was talking about the industrial. He was talking about Germany, France, the United States, England, right? And it didn't happen. But his reasons for thinking it was inevitable were pretty spot on. But then it turns out the capitalist class can actually read and use his predictions to kind of figure out what's coming and to try to head it off through, you know, any number of things, right? And so his point was, and he starts talking about how by making predictions, you can kind of in a weird way prevent some of the worst stuff by bringing it out there. And it's pretty obvious. You're like, oh, that's what he's doing.
Okay. Right?
You know, and so it starts dawning on me, like, okay, he's, you know, I'm with him. I probably still disagree with a lot of his stuff, but it's okay, I see what he's doing here. And no, it's not crazy. Did you catch that? I thought that was an interesting way to kind of bring, like, show his hand a little bit, you know?
Yeah, I get what you're saying. And the sort of the idea of, like, being, you know, predicting the future, like, how humanity's going to move forward, it doesn't seem like there's much room for in the middle. It's either, humanity's going to go, you know, keep going up and it's going to be all this new stuff. People are going to live forever or like a doom scenario where humanity's going to fall off a cliff. There's no, like, I don't think they're selling books where people are like, yeah, it might just kind of stay not that different for a while. Yeah. And
same old. And
yeah, I don't know if that's getting the, penguins paying, you know, seven figures for that book. But who am I? He had a section, I don't know if you got this point, and he's talking about like the relationship between animals and humans, and then he starts talking about AI. He kind of talking about why we value humans more than like animals, and then in relation to what if you made like computers smarter than humans. And he has this part, he goes, would it be okay, for example, for artificial intelligence to exploit humans and even kill them to further its own needs and desires? If it should never be allowed to do that, despite its superior intelligence and power, why is it ethical for humans to exploit and kill pigs? I don't know if I agree with the whole thing, but it's kind of an interesting thought experiment.
That's a good point, yeah.
You know, it's kind of a, well, if you create AI and it's going to be like smarter and more powerful than you,
should maybe
the consequences of like, what if it turns on you?
It theoretically could go that way. Yeah.
That whole statement is based on the fact that the reason why we kill and eat pigs is because we're smarter than them. But
and we got into our heads, it's okay. Yeah. Which there's a couple of good points, like things I highlight is like, oh, that's true. Like it's interesting when he talks about how we can't really hit the brakes, even if we wanted to. Like when he starts getting into, here are some of the dangers of this. It's like, well, why we stop? It's like, well, because, you know, nobody can absorb all the latest scientific discoveries. Nobody can predict how the global economy will look in 10 years. And nobody has a clue where we are heading in such a rush. Since no one understands the system anymore, no one can stop it.
Who do you think this book? Who do you think this book is for?
I don't know. The public. It's sold really well.
I have a theory that it's sort of for his own celebrity and personal influence in a way. Like,
yeah. So
you can disagree with it. You can agree with it. But either way, it's almost like talk radio in a way. Like, it's sort of.
I won't.
I don't know how I like to express how I think, but it's almost. He gets the most out of this book.
Like, sure, but I don't think he's a sell. I think he's found his niche, and he's you want to say pop historian or something, maybe? Like a David McCullough type, you know, like pop history, that's fine. But I don't think he's saying stuff he doesn't mean. I think he's kind of thought out. I
get this a little bit of the sense he's almost a pop thinker, which is not really he thinks about things, but I don't feel like he ever dwells on or like delves into him all that deep. Like we're
sure
might write a whole book about one of his like, you know, 5-page sort of mini essays. He just kind of keeps on going, and it's kind of, it's engaging. You can kind of think about stuff, and then you're on to the next subject. And then from there, kind of has this interesting idea kind of in the middle of the book about how human beings need cooperation to sort of become more advanced. Like that was a key thing for them. And sort of he talks about subjective and objective, and there's like a third thing that humans need to sort of, you know, succeed in society. So there are like interesting ideas, but I was wondering who's the book for, but what? Because it gets all this praise, and I think it almost makes people feel like that when they read it, they become, a key to the secret of the future, which I don't think is completely accurate, because it's, I don't think he states he knows the future, but I don't know.
Two things. Yeah. So if we're going to call him pop history, which I think is fair, you can mean that in a good or bad way, but pop history, then the audience would be the populace, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's fair to call him pop because it was a New York Times bestseller. It's, you know, he's like Malcolm Gladwell type stuff, best-selling, little, you know, stuff to chew on, whatever. So the other half of my capitalized note thing I have, which is, have you heard the term court historian?
Okay.
Let me bring it up. So it'll come in handy when we talk about Burr and Vidal. And I got the term from him.
Okay.
Right. So there's a historian. So if you think about like a European court when back in the days of kings, think of Louis XIV or whatever, he would have his court historians and their role. And it was never explicit, right? Mm-hmm. If you were the court historian, you kind of knew you need to have your story, your history needs to kind of be favorable towards not only King Louis, mm-hmm. but his lineage. His father and grandfather have to be presented. You can never throw any doubt onto the legitimacy of the king. So your history just has to reflect the glory of France, and especially the glory of, I want to say the Bourbon, but whatever house, like a court historian for Henry VIII would have to be very Tudor friendly. You know what I mean? And that's just how it goes. It's never explicit. It's probably not even all that conscious. You just kind of, if you make your way to being the court historian, that's just, you know, that's part of your duty. And right. So that's your, so is Harari, I was saying, is he kind of the court historian for tech millionaires, right? He's Peter Thiel and Musk and that whole set. He's their court historian. Does that make sense?
Do you feel like he's ultimately on the side of tech versus?
We'll find out, because he is kind of throwing some warnings out there.
Yeah.
In the middle of this book. And you know what? And court historians make readable and decent. They can be decent historians. You just have to keep in mind you're maybe not getting the whole picture. They're going to be biased towards power because that's their gig, right? So I will see if that's fair by the time we finish it, but that's kind of how I'm conceptualizing it in my mind.
He does. I'll say this, my last thought on this. He does have some interesting like examples from history when he's trying to make his points. And it's kind of an interesting, almost historical aspect of the book. Sometimes I wonder if it's a good use of those like antidotes to sort of be like, sometimes it's a little broad, and that's kind of some of my issue with the book. It's, I don't know if he's applying like what he's talking about to the example. It's not a one-to-one match sometimes in my book, but it does make for interesting reading and kind of, I don't know if I don't know how to put it, but yeah, I still don't think he's like the genius thinker that sort of all the blurbs say, but it makes for an interesting book. Which
sure.
Maybe that's what he's going for, but
I find him engaging. I don't know. I kind of like him. We'll see where it's headed.
I wish it was more structured. I will say.
Yeah. Okay. That's interesting. I just personally, taste wise, I don't mind it.
Okay.
But I think I see what you mean. I just have my, you can probably tell my mind's a little, it's the raw egg and the coffee I just had, but I can roll with them. I didn't spend all day listening to him on podcast to kind of prep because I spent all week reading the wrong essay.
So well, that was my fault. Today. That was my fault.
Yeah, no, it's all right. But there was a podcast with Harari and Steven Pinker. And I don't like Steven Pinker. So compared to, but that's the kind of class. Malcolm Gladwell, Steven Pinker, Harari, I think, are kind of the same. Well, maybe it's like easy listening, a radio channel or something. Like it's not as like pop, like the John Mayer, Jason Mraz, Billy Joel radio station that plays in
right up your alley.
Days or whatever. Well, yeah. But you know what I mean? It's like that level of there's more artsy and deeper stuff out there. But the, you know, it's this is readable / listenable and
yeah, it's
I think that's kind of.
I definitely understand why it's a bestseller.
You don't?
No, I do. It's very why it's a bestseller.
Yeah. And it deals with issues. I think it's important stuff to bring up. He's kind of okay. One of the things I wrote down he said in the podcast was when you think of tech, you have to kind of, you know, tech isn't necessarily always a good thing. It's not neutral, or it is neutral. It can be, imagine tech in the hands of your worst enemy or your most hated political rival or whatever, because it's not just going to be the good guys or the guys on your side that are going to use it. And that was kind of refreshing because more people.
No, that is a good
need to think like, yeah, and do that with more than tech too. All the stuff with the, you know, rewriting the old books to be more sensitive to. It's like even if you agree with that, imagine this in the hands of somebody who you disagree with. Are you okay with Christian fundamentalists going through and changing everything to be more biblically accurate?
He get into the Bible later on the book and sort of.
Well, sure. But you know what I mean? Like, let's just imagine whatever's being done to you rather than by people you agree with. It's a good metric for judging things.
Before we pivot over to the Cabinet of Curiosities, I do have an example of AI not being all that useful.
Sure.
I was getting a haircut. And I was talking to the person cutting my hair, and they had like their phone kept ringing, and then like the receptionist in the other room answered it, and I go, oh, okay. And she was kind of like very not friendly, but like kind of to the point. And I was like, oh, that's an interesting way of like answering the phone. And the person cutting my hair goes, oh, who was that? And she goes, oh, that was Google was calling me. And apparently you can go online with this haircut place to get my haircut and like request a time to get your haircut with somebody who works there, and then Google will then call their store and be like, hey, so-and-so wants a haircut tomorrow at noon with so-and-so, and then the people have to be like, no, that's not available, we have someone available at 11 or something like that. And so what ends up happening is Google then calls the person back who made the appointment and says, by the way, that doesn't work for them. And so they actually have to call the store again and be like, hey, what time do you have? Instead of, so they try to go Google, but Google doesn't know when they schedule, right?
Yeah.
It's just kind of like, oh, this seems they haven't truly figured out this, you know, I don't even know what the function would be. It seems more of a hassle for everybody involved. You could just call the first time and be like, hey, what can I get a haircut? Instead of being I want to get a haircut this time. And Google's like, we don't have their schedule, but we will schedule it for you.
That seems like a whole bunch of unnecessary steps.
Seems like someone got a raise creating that at Google. Like, hey, I created this thing where you can just schedule haircuts, and someone's like, oh, awesome. Put that in the, you know, code.
And then, Well, that's one of the things I wonder about AI. It won't necessarily be the most efficient or the most brilliant thing. It'll be a lot of stuff like that, but it'll be all there is. And that's the danger. You know, it won't be great. It'll just be, you got to deal with a bunch of little snafus like that, that people coding it don't even think of because they don't use it. And then us people on the ground, like, this is terrible. You know? Yeah. So,
all right, Matt. Last thing tonight, we over on our Patreon, we have our thriller corner, and we have picked the Cabinet of Curiosities. And what we do every time we read a thriller is we kind of create some prop bets or some odds. This is a little bit different because you've read the book. So it's kind of I came up with six sort of questions and kind of want to see if, don't say anything, but just curious if they're going to be accurate or what the odds are. And I think you have a list of stuff too. So
we'll see. Yeah, we'll set down our bets. And then if you want in on them, like Thad does them.
Okay.
And if you want, yeah, you know, if you join on Patreon, you get a, you know, join in on these as prizes and whatnot.
Do you want to start off with your list and see where
we're going? I only have two because I have to be careful.
Yeah, yeah. That's good.
It's been a while. I'm excited to revisit it, but I do remember who done it, right? Okay. So I don't want to, even creating certain categories, you would know that one of them is the correct one. You know what I mean? So I was very careful. I'm just going to stay neutral in this.
Based mine off of basically the blurbs and the short description on the back of the book.
Yep. And you do. And this is what makes it fun is when we go into this without either of us having read it, it's just what you think it's going to be about. Just reputation, the cover, whatever, you know, what do you think is going to happen here based on the reputation of the book and whatnot. So mine are just what's in the cabinet.
Okay. That's close to my first one. My first one was, is there a cabinet in the story?
Like a literal
physical cabinet.
Okay. We'll put that literal cabinet / what in it. Not what it, just what in it.
What in it? What in?
And it's the deck to Pendergast is eccentric. What are some of his eccentricities?
Okay.
Right. So whatever you think they might be.
Let me see what I feel like. Okay. He's the story kind of.
Like Sherlock Holmes had a hunting cap and a pipe.
What do I think is in Pendergast? I never thought this isn't one of my.
You don't have to do it now.
I'm going
to
say. That's not really all that eccentric. I was going to say he has like a shoulder. He's got a backpack or something. He has a backpack.
It's a backpack.
Okay. That's weird for an F. He's an FBI agent, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And he works alone. He's sort of alone, kind of.
I'll go ahead and say, yeah, that's his.
Okay.
If you try to saddle him with a partner, boy, you won't like that.
Can't have that. He's going to be a lone guy. All right.
Those are good. And then you got a little time. You can think about it.
My second one, is there a cabinet in the story? If so, what's in the cabinet? And I feel, my guess is human, like, bones.
Bones. Yeah.
Okay. Because the story from the sounds of it is they find all these bodies in this sort of, what is it, like the house where you store bones under New York City in like an abandoned tunnel from like, I assume, beginnings of New York City. Is that correct? And then the killings start up again. And what's the connection there? Okay, so that's where I kind of some of my prop bets off of. Secret is there a secret society? I was wondering.
Oh, that's a good one.
And I'm going to say yes. This has all the markings of a secret society. I think I'm a little bit, I think Dan Brown's kind of getting into my head a little bit with this. I don't know why.
Yeah.
I'm feeling a little bit like secret. Oh, like who's who. And we might not get that until the very end is what I'm feeling, but secret society. Yes.
Nice.
My next one is, does a pile of bones fall on our protagonist? Does a pile of bones fall on our protagonist? Maybe he's like in there in the trying to get some clues and a pile of bones falls on him. I'm going to say yes for that.
I like that one.
Plus 500 is a little bit of an odd choice for a scene, but I think a pile of bones falls on our protagonist. Okay. If this happens, I'm going to text you and be like, the pile of bones has fallen on him.
I don't remember. You may
okay.
have been.
Hey.
And it doesn't have to be a protagonist. It could be, because okay. there's That's a couple.
Fair. That's fair.
I will just, like with many, like Watson and Sherlock Holmes, you get Pendergast's perspective from an NYPD detective. Like, you get him from another.
Okay.
Which is smart, because with, like, brilliant, he's incredibly brilliant, right? Deductive reasoning. And so it makes him more mysterious and compelling to have an outsider see his actions and you're not in his head.
Good point.
It's good. It's good to, yeah.
One of the blurbs called it a scientific thriller. So who cracks the case? A scientist, a cop, a janitor, or a museum worker? Who helps crack the case? Museum worker helps crack the case is my guess.
There's got to be who helped, because you know our detectives.
Yeah, our detective's going to crack. But who helped?
That's a good one, because there are several revolving. Okay. Who helps? That's good.
Because I was reading about it. I was like, okay, anthropology is sort of involved in the book. I'm going to guess museum worker. I think there might be a museum. If not, put it in. So that's I'm going to say museum worker. And my last one is the New York City mayor's office involved? All right. This book takes place in New York City. Maybe, you know, the big government there. I'm going to say yes. The mayor's office is involved in some way.
But does the mayor show up? Is the mayor called? He doesn't have to be involved in the murder.
I don't think he's in a scene, but I think one of his maybe like lieutenants, if that's probably not the right, but like, hey, you know, we got some issues here.
We need you to crack this case, or whatever it is, the mayor's office.
If the mayor shows up, the mayor is involved in the secret society that I've already predicted. That's...
Okay.
How are my prop bets?
Those are really good, Peter.
I kind of had fun coming up with them with knowing so little about this book.
That is what makes them fun. Right? I mean, it is fun.
I know. The Lions Lucerne, we came up with, you know, chocolate and...
Right, because it's Swiss. Yeah. So
how much Swiss? I'm really... I am curious about the literal cabinet. There's not a literal cabinet. I'm curious how the title fits in.
Yeah.
I guess the curiosities, too. Bones. Are bones curious? I don't know. Can bones be curiosities? Or is it a key? Is it a bunch of keys, Matt? Don't tell me.
Can't say. It's probably other stuff.
I'm excited to read the book.
It's a fun... I got... My copy is selected as one of 100 best thrillers ever by NPR.
Get out of town.
It's a good book. I'm excited. It's
the third in the series, correct? By Preston and Child.
The third is a good place. It's where I started with the series way back.
They do a good thing in the beginning of the book. They say the first two should be read in order, correct?
Relic and Reliquary, yeah.
And then this is the third one. It seems like you can kind of start here fresh.
I've read about 20 and I haven't read the first. Okay. I still haven't read Relic. I started with this. And I've read like, I think the rest of the 20. So yeah, this is a good place to start.
And like I said, this is, you'll hear our episode about the book over on our Patreon, which is not a lot of money to join and support us, but we have a lot of fun over there. So. Any other bookish thoughts, Matt, tonight? We kind of covered a lot of stuff. Negative review. You told me about C.S. Lewis and the seven planets, one of them being the moon. We talked about Harari, our thoughts on that. Set some prop bets up for a thriller corner. How's your reading day to day? Are you getting good time to read? Are we doing some audio books? Where are we at?
Doing some audio. I'm making more time in the mornings, trying to get up early. I really enjoyed the David Foster Wallace essay.
I will get to it.
I'm not upset with you. I'm not even upset with you. I was like, I enjoyed the essay. I'm making good progress in Jaber Crow.
That your dad will like that. He will enjoy that.
Get him off my back. I'm going to be going on the road next week, I think.
So we're going to, so next week we're going to try and record, I think, right?
Yeah, and I might try to pull some, if I can find an hour or two, I'll sneak off and record this. We might, we'll do probably some prop bets. I'm going to bring the Nicholas Sparks with me.
Oh.
Before I start reading, I'll have my prop bet. We'll do the Sparks prop bets.
Okay.
I might try to have special guests. We'll see if I can drag some people into the room.
I like that. It's my favorite. I realize this. I don't think I've told you this. This is my favorite time to read during the year. Summertime.
Summer.
I like it.
You go outside, out on the porch.
Sometimes I go outside. Sometimes I just, you're like, oh, I've been reading for a while, and it's still light out, and it's like 8 o'clock. I love that. Some of my happiest memories of reading are in summertime, kind of as it gets late.
That is,
Is that sappy?
No, that's me too. Actually, I'm looking forward to starting Shoeless Joe, because I think that would be the perfect summer.
That's a perfect summer book. That's also on our Patreon, where we read baseball books.
Yep.
Yeah.
Well, I started all four. It's pretty good too.
You said that, yeah?
Oh, yeah. With it being light in summer, like the kid is starting getting up anywhere from like 5:30 to 7, so you never really know. But there are some days you hear him walking around, like knocking on his door, and you know, I'll open my eyes and it's light out, and I'll be like, oh, at least he slept in a bit. But I look at the clock and it's 5:45. It just happens to be light out. So
you gotta teach him the seasons and time and clocks.
It's easy to say. And it is light out, so he's up with the lights.
I mean, he's not wrong.
You can't explain anything to him.
If you ever take him to like the wintertime at like north of Scotland, he's like, I guess I gotta sleep all the time. This is wild.
I doubt that's how it worked, but it might be worth it.
You know what?
It might be worth moving up north. If it actually did work, I'd consider moving to Scotland or Alaska just for some sleep.
The issue would be the summertime.
Because it never gets dark.
It would be dark for 4 hours.
The winter up north for the extra sleep. You do the opposite of what normal.
Hibernation?
Yeah. Basically, you'll hibernate. Take your kids up north so I can get some darn sleep.
There you go. I think that's a good place to end the episode. As always, thanks for listening. Check us out on Patreon. And we got... Our TBR has a ton of fun books. Books for all different kinds of readers. So... don't unsubscribe if you were reading the Nicholas Sparks. I think that's going to be a fun book to read, that's
And we'll make it literary too. We'll talk about the difference between genre fiction and blah. We'll dress it up. We'll sort of pseudo intellectual whatever.
Well, everybody have a happy 4th of July, and we will talk to you next week.